If you've already got a successful business, if you've got somebody who's willing to put up the capital to dump into a risky idea, then go ahead and try and be a pioneer. If you don't have that, which is 99% of entrepreneurs out there, if you can't afford to gamble on a revolutionary idea, then don't make the gamble. That's my advice. And I know that that's not what people want to hear, but I'm a big fan of, if you're going to gamble, only gamble if you have the money to throw away. If you're going to go to Vegas, only take money that you don't mind losing. If you can afford to throw away $100,000 pursuing a risky venture, go ahead and do it. But if you're the average entrepreneur, don't do it at all.
Yeah, hello everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is Tuesday, February 19th. Very, very late at night. Excuse me, it is actually Wednesday, February 20th. Very, very early in the morning. I should not be in front of a computer screen right now if I ever wish to go to bed. But before I turned in, I did want to bring a project that I started today to completion. It is a conversation with my good friend, Nathan Frazier. Many of you already know who Nathan is. He's been on the show several times in the past. He is a successful copywriter and marketer. His services website is copyandfunnels.com, but he is also a podcaster. If you want to learn more or listen to his show, you can access that through nathanfrazershow.com. And we're going to be talking about a couple other ways you can connect with him on the show today. So this is a conversation he and I have had not in front of microphones. It's an ongoing conversation we've been having for years. And it is a question of why most small businesses, most entrepreneurial pursuits do not work and what can be done about that. We focus our conversation in on a scene that he and I have both been a part of for the last decade, but it expands beyond the question of whether or not activism or a passion for liberty can be monetized. A couple of the key takeaways from today's show. You'll learn the most common reasons activists or people pursuing passion projects more generally fail at business ownership, and how you can tell if your business idea is actually worth pursuing. We'll get to that in just a minute. A couple of announcements first. In the last podcast, I talked about the coming School Sucks virtual summits. We're looking to do the first one this spring. I want to say thank you to everybody who provided feedback. I could not even believe how many people opened the email that I sent last Monday, how many of you read it, and how many of you responded to it. It took me a week to process all of the responses, but as a result, I have now narrowed down what is the best foot forward for School Sucks for our first virtual summit to three options. If you want to have further input, there is a poll in the School Sucks Facebook group. And I'm sorry if you've been waiting for acceptance into the group. I do like to try and vet people a little bit before I let them in. Do you have a profile picture that is a person? Do you have what appears to be a real name? Are you in 600 other groups indicating to me that you're just somebody who likes to join groups? I want people who are really interested in what we do at School Sucks. And it'd be nice if we had a few mutual friends or some overlap in the groups we're a part of. So I'm a little slow to do that. The group does have over 2,000 people in it already. If you are already in the group, please vote. The three options that we've narrowed it down to. Number one, what I called input overload, survival skills for the age of fake news. This is an idea we've been kicking around for over a year. Back in 2017, I remember saying, gosh, we really probably shouldn't use the phrase fake news. It's kind of an ephemeral buzzword. Wrong. Wrong. News is only getting more fake, folks. And the news landscape is becoming increasingly complex. So I think that is a really valuable exploration. One of the other ideas from the personal development sphere was the six pillars of self-esteem essential practices. And what the idea is there, I'll bring together a group of people that I feel are masters of Nathaniel Brandon's six pillars, six actions that lead to more positive self-regard. We'll go through each pillar and establish two or three really, really valuable practices to make that pillar or that practice concrete in your life. And the option that currently holds first place is simply called developing effective research skills, right? How can you confront this enormous reservoir of information, even conflicting information on a given topic, and turn it into, I don't know, say lemonade? I think that's how the saying goes, right? You start with a reservoir, you end with a glass of lemonade. In other words, you're looking at something that's big, overwhelming, clearly not drinkable, and you're filtering it down to something that is enjoyable and functional. And man, I could put together a really powerful group of presenters for that one. So I understand why it's in first place. Please go and vote. I'll let this poll run for the remainder of the week, and then I'm making a decision and moving on to the next step, which means recruiting presenters for this project. Also, right now, School Sucks is entirely listener supported. We do not have advertisers. You're never going to hear me tell you about how some underwear is great. If you are having problems with your underwear, there's really nothing I can do for you, right? That is like the first step to starting any day. Put on underwear. If you're sitting there on the edge of your bed wearing nothing but a pair of boxer shorts going, how could this be better? You're going to have a very unproductive day. Put on your underwear, cover them with pants, and get on with it. Now, of course, I do not want to alienate anyone who has this problem. There is a company called MeUndies that I have suffered through other podcast hosts feigning enthusiasm for. So maybe they have a solution if you really need one. I'm sure their website is MeUndies.com. But how we do things here, listeners make School Sucks Project possible. They do that through a membership program. The oldest and most popular way is called the AV Club. You can see all of the joining options at schoolsucksproject.com/AV. Or if you are just interested in supporting the show, letting me know you're finding the show valuable, you can go to patreon.com/schoolsucks. You'll get access to all the bonus content we've done since 2016, including every episode, 20 plus hours of our very positively reviewed supporter-only show, The Discomfort Zone. Season 2, Episode 2 came out this week. It is a long one, and it is more uncomfortable than my current pair of underwear. So please help us out, patreon.com/schoolsucks. All right, without further ado, here's my conversation with Nathan Frazier. Thank you for listening, and take care. Nathan, welcome back to School Sucks.
Thank you for having me. I feel like I have almost moved in.
Yeah, this is great. You were just here last month, and we're back today for an entirely new topic. We talk a lot off the air. One of the things that we've spoken about over the last couple of weeks is we have both been participants, and I think it's fair to say, to reveal, that we have both been critical observers of an interesting scene over the last decade. Some people call this the Liberty Movement. I really don't know what that means. I really don't like that phrase very much. More generally, libertarian activism. We've seen, you know, in this very dynamic environment, a lot of people arrive, a lot of people disappear. We've both changed our role in it significantly since I became involved back in 2009.
Yeah, absolutely.
We first encountered each other. You interviewed me for a show called Live Free FM. This was 2012, I want to say, and we did this long conversation on the Prussian influence on American education. And you went by Paranoid. That was your name at the time. That was your handle on the show.
Yeah, that was a long time ago. That was when I had my first business, which was an underground hip-hop record label, and that was my MC name when I was on the stage, and so I just adopted that into the podcasting world.
So later on, I was reintroduced to you as Nathan Frazier. You and I, it's amazing. It's been 4 years that we've been in a mastermind together. Drew and Daryl have also been there the entire time. You know, in 2015, you came back on the show. We talked about goals, and you've been like fairly regular contributor since then. And I've been on your show a couple of times since then.
Yeah, I take advantage of your audience a lot more than I let you come on and share your knowledge with my audience. I kind of feel guilty about that.
That's an easy thing to fix. We can fix that in no time. And I'm always happy to come on when you need a guest. But today, I think we should just dig right in and talk about our observations of the attempt to monetize enthusiasm for liberty. I definitely have tried to do it. I know you tried to do it in the past, and now you've learned some lessons and moved away from it. But when somebody talks about that proposition, right, turning political activism or this passion for freedom into a revenue stream or into their sole source of income, what comes to mind for you?
You know, I remember a conversation. I think it was like a Twitter conversation or a Facebook conversation that Tom Woods, one of our mutual acquaintances, and another guy who's kind of lost favor in the liberty world, Chris Cantwell.
Never had favor.
Okay. They were having a conversation one time, and Tom was saying it's not a good idea to try and monetize your liberty activism. It's really weird because I think Tom has done a fantastic job of monetizing liberty activism. Chris Cantwell, not so much. At the time, I was selling t-shirts. I was making kind of a killing using Facebook ads to sell t-shirts. And most of my t-shirts were liberty themed. And I think that there is a market in the liberty crowd. I think more so though, a lot of libertarian people tend to like the prospect of being their own boss, whether it's a lot of times it's, I want to take my activism and be able to monetize it sometimes or mm-hmm. somehow. But I also know that a lot of the libertarian people that I've met, a lot of the quote unquote anarchist people that I've met are entrepreneurs, are people that start their own business or at least attempt to start their own business. And sometimes it's within a role of activism, and sometimes it's, I want to be somebody who is a garage repair person and it has nothing to do with liberty, but they just don't want to work for somebody else, which kind of makes sense. We don't like authority figures. We don't like being told what to do. So starting our own business seems like a natural next step.
But at this point, I think an interesting problem kind of presents itself. The answer to the question, why are so many liberty activists attracted to entrepreneurship? Sure. There's a strong drive to be as free as possible, right? The connection here is kind of obvious. I remember 4 years ago, you recommended a book to me called Outwitting the Devil by Napoleon Hill. He talks about in that book, by the way, people probably know Napoleon Hill because he wrote The Master Key to Riches and Think and Grow Rich. But there was this book called Outwitting the Devil that never got released. I mean, he wrote it back in the 30s and it did get released, but in like 2011. And I guess his wife thought invoking the devil in the title of a book was too controversial for the time. But it's sort of this imagined conversation with evil embodied. And, you know, Napoleon Hill talks about what the devil's schemes are. And one of the schemes is to turn mankind into aimless drifters, people who are purposeless, who never accomplish anything, who move directionless through life. And one of my observations has been of just libertarian activism and maybe a quest to monetize activism or that passion. People move from one thing to another. You know, I can think of people who it seems like every 6 months they have a brand new project that's the best thing in the world. But 6 months later, there's nothing left to say about that and they're on to something else. He warns in the book about becoming an aimless drifter. And if your number one priority that is driving you to be an entrepreneur is freedom, I think you stand a better chance of acting without purpose, of acting without direction, and winding up just wandering from one thing to the next, as long as that desire to be free from the boss or the 9-to-5 or the commute is satisfied.
You know, that's something that doesn't just plague liberty activist entrepreneurs either. That's something that a lot of quote unquote entrepreneurs in general suffer from, is what a lot of us call bright, shiny object syndrome. Oh, I'm going to chase this opportunity. Oh, somebody's making a bunch of money drop shipping. I'm going to go do that. Oh, you can be a marketer and make money. I'm going to go do that. Oh, you can make money by running people's Facebook accounts. I'm going to go do that. Every week there's a new opportunity and they end up going and chasing that. But the problem with that is the way I view it is like you've got a nail and a board and a hammer, and you've got a certain amount of swings. You've got maybe 10 swings right. before your time is up. And if you swing once and you beat the nail down a little bit into the board, and then you say, oh, that didn't work. I'm going to pick the nail out and I'm going to put it a different place. Maybe this place in the board will be softer. And you swing again, and that one you didn't get very much further. So you take the nail out and you pick a third spot and you swing again. You're never going to penetrate through the board. If you would have just stuck with that same spot with those three swings, you would have made it through and you'd already have a successful business. And that's a lot of people do that. They say, oh, it didn't work as fast as I wanted to. So they pull the nail out and they put it in a new spot and they try a new idea. And they never give any one idea enough attention to actually make that penetrating blow.
That's great advice. It's advice you've given me off the air before when I said, oh, I have this beautiful shiny new nail that I want to hit. And you said you're like two strikes away from getting the first nail through the board. Why don't you hit that one a couple more times? I think the metaphor was different. I think we were using trees and fruit, but same conclusion applies. It's definitely good advice to stick with one thing for sure, but that's only one piece of the puzzle. Have you ever heard of a book by, I think his name was Chris Gillibrew. It's called The $100 Startup, gimmicky entrepreneurial introduction book. I mean, this probably comes up in a lot of these books. It definitely comes up in the 4-Hour Work Week. One of the most important things that he's trying to hammer home in that book is passion, which is what motivates a lot of people who are liberty-minded to venture into entrepreneurism. In that book, he says it's about a third. You also need skills and you need to know how to attract customers. Customers who want to pay for what you're offering. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of people are taken a little bit too far forward sometimes by passion, and maybe even are, if they are willing to just keep hammering that same nail, they don't have some of the other skills and they haven't made some of the other really important considerations to be successful.
Yeah, you really have to find your overlap. And that's I don't want to say the problem, but that's one of the downfalls of trying to turn activism into a business is that a lot of activist people are very selfish and they assume that the content that you create or whatever it is that you create for them, you should be doing it for the cause. You shouldn't be trying to make money off of it. And they're not willing to pay. So you might have incredible skills. You might have something you're very passionate about and other people are very passionate about consuming. But if they're not willing to pay you to do it, there's not a viable business model there. And especially like activist people, a lot of them are just not willing to pay for what they assume should be free. Oh, well, everybody else does their podcast for free. Why should I pay for your podcast? Everybody else goes out and preaches the good word of liberty for free. Why should I pay you to do it? So it's a very difficult thing when people can get and when they're used to getting what you provide for free, trying to convince them to pay for it is it's not always the easiest thing to do.
Here's another piece of that, right? Because we know lots of people who've tried to monetize liberty projects or activist projects, even if they're podcasts or YouTube channels, or there's kind of an uncomfortable realization here. I want to get your thoughts on this. A lot of role playing goes on in social media and in activism generally. And as I've observed things over the last couple of years, I've wondered if a lot of people really don't see the things that they're advocating for as realistic. I think a lot of people are participating in this conversation, but they don't believe any of the things they're talking about. Like deep down, on the level that inspires action, they don't believe that anything is actually going to happen or actually going to change. And it's also related to this problem of people letting their attention and efforts be sucked out of their sphere of control. If you're not focusing on how you can get more individual liberty, how you can have more freedom in your own life, most people would probably be pretty unwilling to invest in like, well, this will make the world free, or this is part of the project to free the world. I think deep down, people understand that there's no panacea for that.
Yeah, I think there's two different ways to go with it. Number one, probably the best way to do it is kind of like what Stefan Molyneux does, which is I'm just going to create this. And if you find value in it, please send me some money. And that was when I was heavily focused on activism. That was my model as well. And I never became a Bitcoin billionaire like Stefan Molyneux has become, but I was getting pretty reasonable donations, and there was enough people that were willing to hand over some money to say that they found what I was doing valuable and they wanted to exchange some value. But as far as getting people to actually buy something based off of that, or make an actual transaction, it's just not viable. And I think that it's because what you're trying to sell somebody, it's something that's out in the ether. It's a new idea, a new culture, a new way of being, but that's not tangible. Like when you sell something to somebody, they want to, especially nowadays, people want that microwave popcorn. They want that instant result. They want to, when they give you money and you say, hey, you're giving me money because I'm selling you something, they want those instant results. They want to see right away what they're buying. They want to be able to hold it in their hand. They want to see the result of it. And when you're selling what we're trying to sell, which is a better way to organize society, I don't know if there is a way to actually turn that into a business model.
So if you can't give them something tangible, right, that's a very easy thing to sell. You give me money and then see this thing, it'll be in your hand and you can do whatever you want with it. Okay, that works. Or something that is an easy win. Now you don't know how to do this and you need to know how to do this to do X, Y, and Z. After this, you'll know how to do this. Here are a bunch of other people who have purchased this information product and look at them now. That's easier too. But when you kind of scale up to this more general or more nebulous picture, yeah, you're right. People are going to be less and less willing to invest money in a project like that.
Mm-hmm. And it's just part of how we are as human beings. We work hard for the money that we have. And if we're going to spend it on something, we want to be able to see the results from it. We don't want some vague promise out in the ether. We want to see direct results. And if what you're promising is some vague promise that might come to fruition 5, 10, 50, 150 years from now, you're definitely better going with the please donate. I'm the guy out here with the guitar and dancing monkey. And if you enjoy what I'm doing, here's a coffee cup. Please put some money in it.
The guitar and a dancing monkey. That sounds great, though. But I take your point. I've also had success breaking down the pursuit of liberty into categories, right? Do you want more freedom in your relationship? Do you want more freedom in your professional life? Do you want more freedom in your health, right? Now you're able to give people more of a step-by-step, more of a direction. You're taking it out of the vague. And you're saying, if you want this specific goal, it's easier to define a path and show people a product or a service that fits that path. But in the whole just broad ideal, again, it kind of goes back to role playing. People love to talk. And, you know, for the last few years in higher education and in social media, we've been able to watch the political left provide a really good mirror, I think, for what a lot of libertarian activism was over the course of the last decade, which is people who just like to say things that make them feel good. And if there is a request or a call for action, most of the people are not going to come to that call. They have just figured out this performance that makes them feel good. So it's, you know, the cliche, all talk and no action. I wanted to get the distinction, right? Because another thing that is very big in the libertarian community is agorism. People love agorism. I've promoted it on School Sucks before. I think there's a lot of people who would benefit from knowing the distinction between true entrepreneurialism and agorism.
I actually was an agorist for a long time. My business model was agorist, and everybody's got their own definition of it. I would say agorism is basically operating in the gray markets, maybe in the black markets. It's basically saying, I'm going to go out and I'm going to provide this product or service, and I'm going to do it without licensing. I'm going to do it without paying taxes. I'm going to do it underground or under the table. It's appealing to a lot of people because they say, well, this is a way I can mix my activism with my dreams of being an entrepreneur. I can go out and make my own money without having to clock in and do a 9-to-5, and I can be sticking it to the man at the same time. I have like a warm spot in my heart for agorism, but I had to leave the agorist model behind. People called me a sellout, and a lot of people questioned my motives once I left the agorist business model, and once I stopped being so reliant on Bitcoin for payments, and once I actually filed the statist corporation and started paying taxes on my work. But the truth of the matter was, especially in what I do, a lot of my clients are people that own businesses, and they're not going to pay me if they can't use it as a tax write-off. And they're going to report that they paid me money. And once I got to a certain point, and I think this is the truth with any kind of business, once you get to whatever you start out doing, Agorist, if you get to the point where you become successful enough, in order to actually serve more people, you're going to have to sacrifice a little bit of those Agorist ideals. And it was a very difficult thing for me to do. And I think that a lot of passionate Liberty people, once they actually become successful at their Agorist dream, they have to make that choice. And to me, even though it means sacrificing principles, it means serving more people. So it's really hard to be a successful entrepreneur and an Agorist at the same time.
So one of the most important distinctions between a true entrepreneurial pursuit and agorism is you really can't scale agorism beyond a certain point. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Agorism is by its very nature, it has a glass ceiling. And if you want to break through it, you're going to have to say, okay, an entrepreneur wants to solve problems at a profit. Same thing with an agorist, but an entrepreneur says, I want to be able to do this on a grand scale. And it's just not possible if you stick to your agorist ideals.
What are some of the other common reasons people who are activists first fail at business pursuits? If those business pursuits are, you know, liberty motivated, or I guess, you know, I mean, this could go beyond. It's not just libertarian people in the audience. People might be motivated by a variety of ideologies or philosophies to pursue business. But if we're just kind of using liberty activists as an example here, why else are they failing?
One of them we already touched on, which is it's their passion. They say, I'm passionate about doing this. I love making jewelry, or I love painting, or I love teaching people how to unschool their children, or whatever the case may be. That's great, but you have to find passion. You have to find that overlap between passion and what other people are passionate about paying for. Mm-hmm. And that is one of those things where, again, you have to make a, I don't want to say a sacrifice, but you have to realize that becoming successful as a business owner isn't about fulfilling your own selfish desires. I know that we're constantly beat over the head with successful people are selfish and greedy and only care about the money. But the truth of the matter is, if you want to be successful in business, you have to sacrifice your own selfish desires in order to meet the wants and needs of the people who are paying you. And so there's a lot of things that I would rather do with my time, because I'm naturally a very creative person. I love creating. I love producing and bringing new ideas into the world and bringing new forms of art into the world. I love writing. I love mixing down audio. These are things I love doing, but I tend to love doing them for myself and for my own goals, but that's not what gets me paid. And so I've had to learn, what is it that allows me to do these things that other people are also willing to pay for? And a lot of people start their businesses without that consideration of what is it that other people actually want to pay for, rather than what is it that I want to do and get paid to do.
Okay. So you have, at this point in your career, managed to create a system, though, where, I mean, you do creative work through copywriting, obviously, and all the production work you do. You have your own podcast. You work with several other podcasters, but you are also the Facebook post master. Like, every time I see I shouldn't say every time, because you do post quite a bit, but if I have time and I'm on Facebook and I see something that you post, I read it, and it's always great. It's always time well spent. And it's also provocative a lot of the time, but it's getting attention to your name, to your brand, and it's sending people through to your work. But it is a creative outlet at, you know, first contact for the people who are seeing it on Facebook. And I just think that's awesome that that's something you get to incorporate into what you do.
Yeah. And I probably lean a little bit too far on my activism when it comes to Facebook, because
sure,
I get a lot of leads from Facebook, but I also know that a lot of times I've actually had people come to me and be like, dude, I almost hired you, but then you posted this Facebook thing and I just can't work with somebody who believes that. And I'm just like, well, I guess we're just not supposed to work together then.
But I bet, on the other hand, you've also gotten a lot of business, right? Because you are somebody who has definitely your own flavor and spice, and you bring that to your work. It's part of being a good copywriter, I would think. So it is also advertising yourself, not just your writing ability, but energy, or I'll use the word provocativeness again, you bring to that pursuit. And there's got to be people who look at that and say, yeah, I would love if this guy wrote something for me.
Yeah. And I have a small kind of online mastermind group called the Free Market Squad, where I bring people in and I teach them how to improve their marketing. And we have certain courses for that. We have certain exercises that help people expand and create their marketing platform. And I occasionally promote that on Facebook as well and through email. And one of the letters that really killed it for me one time, I saw like a 300% increase of signups in a single day off of this. It was a letter basically about learning not to try and sell to the wrong people. And the story was basically, it was an experience that I had as a kid when me and my brother were selling ecstasy at raves. Mm. And one weekend there wasn't a rave. We had a backpack full of pills and we had to get rid of them because they were fronted to us. And so we went out and we were looking for parties. We were trying to find somewhere to sell these pills. And we found a hardcore, we heard about a party that was in the warehouse district of the town we live in. We went to it, we walked in and we realized it was a straight edge punk party. Like these are kids that don't even drink coffee. And so we had a backpack full of product that nobody there wanted to buy. It was kind of like trying to sell, you know, prime steak at a vegan restaurant. Yeah, you've got a great product, but nobody there eats meat. And so the lesson that I walked away with was, it doesn't matter how great your product is, you need to make sure you're selling it to a hungry audience. I wrote a letter about that and I did it worried that I was going to turn off a bunch of people. And like I said, that day I had a ton of people come into the Free Market Squad and almost every single one of them said, I've been following what you did, but it wasn't until you posted this message, which is a very taboo, controversial message, especially in the business world. It wasn't until you had the balls to say that this is where you started that I actually wanted to become a member of your community. And a lot of times, if you really want to be attractive to certain people, you have to be willing to plant your flag in the sand or on a particular hill and say, this is my hill. Everybody who doesn't agree with this, I'm okay with not doing business with you. But those of you that do agree with this, I'm the perfect guy for you or the perfect gal for you. And that's something that's very scary for business owners to do, especially newbie business owners, to be able to say, this is who I serve and I'm willing to sacrifice everybody else so that I can perfectly serve this one core audience.
Right, because of alienation. So I've done the School Sucks podcast since 2009. It was inserted into a scene that is very incestuous as far as I listen to this or I go to this website. So I also go to this website, and I heard about you here. I heard about you there. And, you know, I made a connection like with Stefan Molyneux very early on, absorbed a lot of people from his audience, made a connection with Free Talk Live early on, absorbed a lot of people from their audience. And then that happened several more times till I was looking out at this very diverse group of people listening and asking myself, how am I going to make everybody here happy? And I still, you know, I'll sit here by myself recording a monologue or like the last time I did a solo show or even editing an interview like this one. And I will highlight a part of the show and debate cutting it out, asking myself that question, who is this going to alienate still? And I think over the last couple of years, I've gotten better. Like, look, if this upsets you, if me saying this thing upsets you, this might not be for you, and that's okay. And so that's what you're saying is the strength of reaching out like that. It says, this is who I am. This is what I stand for. It will be for, I hope it's for you. And maybe that's a great way to make a really strong connection, but it kind of shaves off who you might just be there to dabble or lurk.
Yeah. And also the thing about it is if you look at like people that have strong followings, let's take the example of somebody who makes predictions for a living. Let's look at Alex Jones. He's the perfect example of this. He's always making radical predictions. They're going to start civil war next week. Mm-hmm. And for his core audience, they'll forgive him when he's wrong and they'll only remember the times that he's right.
Yes.
And so as somebody who does your thing, if you're willing to plant that flag, people will forgive you when you're occasionally wrong. People will forgive you when you say on your podcast something that they disagree with. I've listened to tons of episodes of your podcast. You are my favorite, hands down, you're my favorite liberty-themed podcast out there. Have been since I heard the first episode way back when you were talking about should parents lie to their kids and teach them about Santa Claus.
Awesome. But,
every once in a while you say something that I'm just like, oh, that rubbed me the wrong way. Every once in a while you'll have a guest on that I'm just like, oh, that just didn't do it for me. But I still tune in and I still love your podcast because the things that I know that me and you share in common, the things that you've taken a steady stand on, those things draw me to you a lot more than the occasional time where you make a stand and I disagree with you pushes me away.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm idealistic in a way too, where I'm like, I hope that if I am a wrong way rubber, you know, that somebody says, ah, you know, I like this guy and that was challenging and I disagree, but I'm going to keep listening for the challenge. I find that like most of the stuff that I'm listening to now are people that I disagree with. Like if I can find a smart progressive, and I found a couple, Jimmy Dore, do you know who Jimmy Dore is?
Oh man, I watch his YouTube channel. I don't know if he has a podcast, but I love watching because I disagree with about half of what he says.
Yeah.
But he makes very compelling points when he says it.
Oh, his like core political beliefs are horrifying, except for, I mean, I guess there's some overlap on like U.S. foreign policy and corporatism and stuff like that. But a lot of it is just very offensive to me. But that's the kind of stuff, like I want media consumption to be active and engaging and challenging. So yeah, I hope that there are people who listen because they like me and they think the whole project is valuable. But I would like to be rubbing more people the wrong way at this point and challenging more, whether it's through things that I say and then it turns into a discussion or through bringing on more challenging guests. I want to start having more uncomfortable conversations on this show.
It's a double-edged sword. So there's two parts to that. Number one, some of my favorite episodes or the most memorable episodes are with guests that I just left being like, what the hell were they talking about? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you also have to understand what are people tuning in for? And most people are tuning in just like when it comes to the news, when it comes to the movies they go to see, when it comes to the music that they choose to buy. People usually tune in because they don't want to hear your opinion. They don't want to hear your guest's opinion. They want to hear their own opinions coming out of your mouth, coming out of your guest's mouth. A lot of people pick the media that they consume based off of, does this confirm what I already believe?
Absolutely.
Is this person going to agree with me? And so as a media producer, you have to be careful. You don't want to deliberately antagonize away your audience. But as somebody who exercises integrity, you also don't want to just completely cater when you know that they might be better served by having some challenging ideals presented.
Yeah. And I just wish there was more of an appetite for that out there in the world, right? One of the times you were on the show within the last couple of years, the episode was called The Echo Chamber, What Was After Some Shooting. And it was me, you, and Drew. And we called it The Echo Chamber Wall Just Got 20 Feet Higher, where every single one of these outside events, outside of a certain echo chamber, if it's caused by something that the inside of the echo chamber is against, like guns or Republicans or vice versa. You could just as easily swap that out for Democrats and gun-free zones inside a Republican echo chamber. It's just like they build the wall 20 feet higher. You know, Jonathan Haidt talks about this. Lots of people. Tim Pool. Are you familiar with Tim Pool? Tim Cast?
I love Tim Pool too.
You know, he's done a lot of good work on what is happening to this country in the conversation through people's social media engagement and, more importantly, lack thereof engagement. So yeah, I would love to be able to set an example, as you know, few other people have done this really well. I think Joe Rogan does a pretty good job with it. I think Hunter Matz and Brian Callen in their mixed mental arts community have done a pretty good job with this as well. But just creating a forum where more people can, following a certain set of guidelines, come together with different, even conflicting ideas, and using those guidelines, like clear communication, empathy, have those difficult conversations and model that, and hopefully that will spread. I do recognize at this point that that is a little naive, but still a signal that I would like to be sending.
Here's the thing about it. People like Tim Pool, he considers himself to be a leftist, but he's willing to give conservative people a fair shake. People like Jimmy Dore, when he starts talking about economics, I'm just like, man, I would never put you in charge of my,
in charge of my junk
when
drawer.
You start talking about economics. But
right.
He's willing to actually sit down and have a fair discussion with people that disagree with him. there is a need for that. There's a lot of people that say, I only watch CNN and I'm never going to listen to anything that might come from Fox News. And there's also people that are like, I'm only going to watch Fox News and I would never listen to anything that comes from CNN, those stupid libtards. But there's a lot of people like us that are just like, hey, I want to have a healthy discussion where we can come to a fair conclusion. And I think that what we see right now, especially in the overall overarching culture that we have going on in America right now, especially when it comes to like the culture war, we have a lot of people that have just dug their heels in on their side. They've only consumed media. They've only consumed messaging from their side. And they've totally otherized people on the other side. Mm. I don't think it's very healthy. But at the same time, that model of media, especially what we've seen recently with like Jussie Smollett, the Covington kids, the way that the media, especially on the left, I think the left is worse with this because they're so expansive, they're so big in comparison that they can get away with more. But the fact that they're just constantly mischaracterizing the story to fit what their audience wants to hear rather than what the actual truth is, to an extent, it's a good business model, but it's getting to the point now where it's becoming toxic and people are leaving, and we're watching CNN lose viewership. We're watching Fox News lose viewership, and we're watching people that are willing to consider both sides, like Tim Pool. One of the things that I like about Jimmy Dore, he's willing to have people he disagrees with come on and they have the discussion. And that is actually, there is a need for that. So it's not everybody who's part of that marketplace, but there is a growing market for that type of discussion.
Yeah. The problem right now that we're talking about, it's also softening brains. It's costing people critical thinking skills, or it's dulling people's ability to engage critically and thoughtfully with things they disagree with. And it's also hurting people's emotional intelligence. Like, if they aren't prepared to sort of stoically stand in the face of something that, I mean, this is like cliche at this point. You could go on YouTube and put in SJW meltdown and have videos to watch for the rest of your life. So I that goes without saying. But one of the best showcases of this right now, Tucker Carlson show on Fox News, where he's still managing to lure in people from academia to debate him. So it shows that this is even having a pretty devastating effect on the minds of smart people. Tucker Carlson is not dumb, but he's not a genius. But he can win debates with PhD academics one night after the next. And he does it simply by like, hey, I'm a Fox News personality. Would you come debate me? And these people look at this from their ivory towers or from their bubbles and they go, oh, a Fox News personality. Yes, of course I'll debate you. But they've never been asked a critical or leading or challenging question for who knows how long. Most of them, at least some of them. Now, sure, that's not to say there aren't plenty of academics, even people on the left, who go out and engage in exchanges of ideas and even debates. But he manages to bring people in there who are just lost in the headlights of pretty simple and straightforward questions, but like mildly challenging. So that is just a good, you can scale that out to the entire media and in the entire internet experience at this point, where people, yes, you're right, they go to certain places for reinforcements. They don't go to other places for challenges. It's extremely energizing. Every Saturday, at some point in the day when I get some free time, I find a ripped version of Real Time with Bill Maher, which is, I would say, one of the best political debate shows on television, which, as I've said before, doesn't say much about television. But he'll put together a panel of people and they'll talk about the issues of the week. And I sit there with my fists clenched, but I watch it, right? I watch it and I find it to be a valuable, challenging experience. So I hope that I can at least use my platform to create more opportunities like that. This has been a magnificent tangent. But I want to get back to the question of reasons why people who are motivated by liberty or liberty activism fail at business. And the other part of that, besides not finding that overlap between here's the thing that I'm passionate about and here's a market where that passion can intersect, right, where there's some overlap. Have you ever heard of a book? It's like a 30-year-old book that I read recently, really easy read. You could read it in a day or two, called The E-Myth.
Oh, yes. I love The E-Myth.
Okay. So The E-Myth was written in the mid-80s. It's by Michael Gerber. And the E in E-Myth, if I'm remembering correctly, is entrepreneur. The idea that there's this entrepreneurial spirit that people are just, some people have it and they can just access it and become successful. And what he asks you to do in the early part of the book, the subtitle of the book is actually Why Most Small Businesses Don't Work and What to Do About It. And even though the book is 30 years old, it was written before, as far as most people knew, the internet even existed. But has a lot of lessons that are still pretty relevant today. And one of the big takeaways is that even if you have great technical skills, it doesn't mean that you're going to be able to run a business. So we talk about there's a cost to the business if you can't do the first thing that you mentioned, right? If you can't match buyers with your passion, if you can't create a product that people are interested in built out of your passion. Tim Ferriss talks about this in the 4-Hour Work Week too. But there's a great personal cost to you, the small business creator or the activist entrepreneur, if you let your passion drag you into something that you're not prepared to do. In the E-Myth, you know, Michael Gerber separates the person pursuing some kind of small business success as three people. There is the entrepreneur, the person with a vision. There is a manager, and there is a technician. So most people become are technicians first, right? They love to make pies, or they love to make, oh God, I don't know, podcasts. And they say, I'm going to turn this into a business. But if they're not prepared initially to be all three of those people, or more importantly, as they try to scale, to understand the roles and the needs of all of those people, they're going to wind up converting that thing that they were passionate about into something that they literally hate. And it's a shame if that thing is freedom, right? In the book, my favorite quote from the book is, if your business depends on you, you don't own a business, you have a job. And it's the worst job in the world because you're working for a lunatic. You're working for a person who is, no offense, schizophrenic, who has several different parts of the personality competing for attention and priority inside that business, right? The technician who needs to do the work, the manager who needs to kind of shape the environment in which the work takes place, and the entrepreneur who has to create the direction for that environment in which the technician works to move in a purposeful direction. So if all of that goes unrealized and it's just the gravity of passion that pulls a person forward, that is a recipe for disaster in almost every case.
I think what people should take away from that is, we'll use your example of making pies. If you love baking pies, it was something that you and your grandma did together, and it was some of the best experiences of your life, and you go out and you get a job and you're like, I love making pies, and you work at some bakery and you say, I could do this. I could run a business. I could make my own pie. I wouldn't have to work for this jackass. I could make my own pie company, and I'd make way better pies than they do. The thing that people don't understand is running a business is not about doing the thing. When you set up your own business, now you're no longer in charge of just making the pies. You're also in charge of advertising. You're in charge of creating schedules. You're in charge of customer service. You're in charge of paying all of the electricity and gas that it takes to run the business. Being a business owner is not about doing the thing. Being a business owner is about managing the business that provides the thing. And that's one of the biggest mistakes that people make, is they say, I'm passionate about doing this thing, and they don't realize that running a business, a good example is podcasting. I love podcasting, but when I started taking on clients, I started realizing I love mixing down audio, but a little wink, wink, and a nod, nod, I hand off a lot of my audio to you.
Yeah.
Because I have to delegate where's my time best spent. And I hate doing taxes. I hate doing paperwork. I hate keeping books. So I hire somebody else to do that. As a business owner, you have to realize it's not just about doing the thing that you're passionate about. It's about making sure that you have a system that delivers what other people are passionate about buying. And a lot of times, if you don't go into it with a healthy perspective or a healthy understanding of that, it's just like you said, you're going to end up hating doing what you're doing. And it kills the passion that a lot of people have for the thing that they do.
No, I thought about it when I had to transition. I mean, I didn't have time anymore 4 years ago. I didn't have time anymore to do my job and to do the show. As the show grew, as the demands of the show, I mean, we were trying to do, you know, a live show. There was a ton of editing. I didn't have anyone to outsource that to. And I said, well, you know, both of these things right now have a lot of unpaid time. Which one am I more passionate about? And in retrospect, I think it was like maybe 2016, 2017, I was like looking out at what I had to do for School Sucks. And I said, I just don't know if I'm that into this anymore. You know, we talked about this at a couple different points. Or I just don't know if I'm that passionate about this. And then there were a number of pressures on me at that time. But what I realized is I needed to think more carefully about what I was trying to do, how I was trying to convert a passion to a job. And instead of like forcing myself into this decision of, well, you know, I can't do my job anymore. At that point, I started thinking, well, gosh, if I just did the podcast once a week as a podcast, and that's all it was, and I figured out how to get 20 hours of, you know, tutoring, even though I don't love it, and even though I don't feel like it's the most helpful thing. You know, I had a story. Yeah, I was a liberty activist, Nathan, by the way. So I had a story that I was telling myself about all of the finger quotes educational work that I was doing. And I still believe that a lot of that story is true, that there was a better way to help people. But it didn't mean just transferring all my efforts into doing a podcast. There's still a better way to help people for me than what I've done so far. So now I'm more purposeful, I think, in that transition into starting at this point where people are like, okay, if you can get my son or daughter's SAT scores to this level, that's worth this much to me. But there's other things that are worth money to people, the people that I've already attracted into this audience. And for the last year or so, I've been really focusing on cultivating and bringing those things into reality. So it kind of renewed my purpose. But your point is that if you just try to convert a passion into a job, you're going to wind up not having that passion anymore. And I felt that way.
And you're going to end up not having a job most likely as well.
It's well, yeah. I mean, I think that that does happen to a lot of people. So there's another part of this as well. One of the reasons why people might wind up being extremely frustrated is they've pursued something that isn't going to lead to any income. They've, again, like we talked about with the E-Myth, they've been dragged along by some kind of passion, in a lot of cases, without the proper planning. Maybe they even get lured along by making a little bit of money here and there or getting donations along the way. And they say, oh, I could easily turn this into something that makes money regularly. But then they find out they can't. And then, like you said, they don't have a job. How can a person tell if they do have a business idea that grows out of a passion for individual liberty or liberty activism, that that idea is actually worth pursuing?
So I'm going to answer this, but I'm not going to make it specifically towards liberty activism. I'm just going to say in general.
Okay.
There's a couple of key ingredients that you need to make sure that you have in place in order to see if an idea is viable. Number one, it has to be something that people are willing to pay for. And that eliminates most liberty activist business models right there. Mm. Also, it has to be something that the people that want it have the ability to pay for, find valuable enough to pay for. And there has to be enough people out there willing to pay for it. This is one of the problems that I had when I was doing the whole t-shirt model design was Facebook made it really easy to target people based off of their interests. I would say, hey, target people that are libertarians or target people who like Tom Wood's show or something like that. Facebook made it really easy, especially back then. You could just pick a page and you could just say, hey, everybody who likes this page, I'd find Tom Wood's podcast page and there'd be 6,000 or 7,000 people that liked it. And I'd be like, everybody who likes it, show them this t-shirt design. It's become a little bit more difficult now. Right. Facebook ads are much more competitive than they used to be. But making $10 or $8 or $12 per t-shirt sale to an audience that's only 6,000 people wide, you have to come up with a new t-shirt every couple of weeks or every couple of months. You have to constantly be working. You have to, it's very hard to scale. And I mean, how many t-shirts is one person going to buy in a year anyways? You're trying to sell to a very small audience over and over and over again. It's very difficult. So the difference between that business model versus what I do now, and I'm not going to say one is better than the other, but right now what I do, I charge people a lot. I'm not just making $8 every time I make a transaction. I'm making multiple thousands of dollars every time I make a transaction. So it's a big difference between what I used to do and what I do now. And the main difference is when I set out to do copywriting and marketing for people, I said, is this something where there's already a proven market? There are people that are willing to pay for this and they've already shown they're willing to pay for this. Are those people willing to pay enough to make it a viable business for me? And are there enough of those people out there that I don't have to constantly try to be selling to the same three people over and over and over again?
Right.
And one thing that anybody that's going to start a business should do is they should ask those questions to themselves. Is this something that's already selling? If not, there's probably a reason that nobody else is selling it, and it's because people aren't buying it. Don't waste your time. Unless you've got like a war chest for research and development, you can't afford to be Steve Jobs. You can't afford to be Henry Ford and bring the automobile when everybody else is buying horses. So ask, are people buying this already? Is there already an established market for this? If so, then it's probably a viable business idea there. And then you have to decide, do I want to sell a high ticket item to a small amount of people, or do I want to sell? Because there's the two different business models. You can be Walmart, where you have tons of people buying from you and you're making a tiny bit of profit off of every single thing, but you have to deal with that type of customer, which I don't want to deal with that type of customer.
In enormous volume.
Or you can say, I'm going to make a lot of profit, but I'm going to only be able to sell to a much smaller market. But you have to find that balance. You have to find, is there enough people that are willing to pay for this? And is it something that people have already proven that they're willing to pay for out there? And a lot of times, it's the biggest mistake that I see a lot of new entrepreneurs make is they say, I've got this revolutionary idea. Nobody's doing this yet.
This
it's
is
a wide open market.
Yeah.
And they don't realize that there's probably already been 10 or 15 people that tried selling it, but nobody was buying it. And that's why nobody's doing it.
Right. When you mentioned Henry Ford, that was my obvious question. Like, what if somebody feels like they have this idea and how can they always be validating? If something has never been done and you don't want to just say, oh, no one's ever done that, so surely it's stupid. I mean, all the greatest ideas fit into that description. So I totally agree with the other tests that you encourage people to run. Like, is there a market for it? Great, then you can probably sell it. But lots of people, especially people who are more iconoclastic or out of the mainstream or countercultural, a lot of the people that we might be talking to, they might be more likely to be part of a group where people generate this novel idea and they want to know if it's viable or not.
Mm-hmm. So typically the people that are going to get behind something like that are going to be like venture capitalists, or they're going to be people that already have, like the iPod is a great example of this. Nobody was selling MP3 players when Steve Jobs came and said, we're going to make the iPod. He brought something revolutionary to the market that nobody knew that they wanted, which was, you know, 1,000 or 1,000,000 songs in their pocket. Nobody knew that they wanted that. He already had a successful business. He had the ability to dump a bunch of money in a risky idea. If you've already got a successful business, if you've got somebody who's willing to put up the capital to dump into a risky idea, then go ahead and try and be a pioneer. If you don't have that, which is 99% of entrepreneurs out there, if you don't already have a successful business, if you can't afford to gamble everything on a revolutionary idea, then don't make the gamble. That's my advice. And I know that that's not what people want to hear, but I'm a big fan of, if you're going to gamble, only gamble if you have the money to throw away. If you're going to go to Vegas, only take money that you don't mind losing. If you're going to risk everything on a crazy revolutionary idea, only do it if it's not going to cost you your house, your wife, your kids, and everything that you own along the way. If you can afford to throw away $100,000 pursuing a risky venture, go ahead and do it. But if you're the average entrepreneur, don't do it at all.
And before we wrap this topic up, building off of the way that your approach to business now, how you get clients and make money now, can you explain to my audience what the 80-20 rule is? So when you talk about, and I think this also relates to the idea of niching down, finding a really specific group of people who want what you have and need what you have.
Yeah. So the overall concept of the 80-20 rule is that 80% of consumption of something happens by 20% of the people, or 80% of production of something happens from 20% of the people. 80% of the travel that goes on in the United States happens on 20% of the roads. When it comes to your business, typically, once you have enough customers, once you have a good system in place where you have upsells and you have ways to extend the customer lifetime profit or customer lifetime value. Once you have these things in place, you're going to start realizing 80% of your income comes from 20% of the people that you're serving. So I guess the way that it applies to business is you're going to come to a point in your business where you realize I've got 100 customers and 80 of these customers, they come in and they spend a little bit of money every time. And then I've got 20 customers who every single time they come in, they spend $500, $600, $700, $800.
Right.
When you come to that point in your business, you start to realize those are the people that I should really focus on. Those are the people that are that have the best leverage. And in I have two different businesses. I'm going to go to the podcasting since most of our listeners are familiar with podcasts. Mm. There was a long time that I was producing podcasts for a wide variety of different people. I was doing comedy podcasts. I was doing Liberty podcasts. I was doing conspiracy truther podcasts, and I was doing business podcasts. So I had a client base of, I don't know, maybe 20 or 30 different people that were coming to me to help them with their podcasts. It got to a point where I realized the people that are doing business podcasts are the ones that are willing to pay me to go the extra mile for them. They're the ones that are willing to pay me what I want to do, what I want to get paid to do the podcast for them. They're the ones that are willing to actually go out and invest in themselves, buy the microphones that they need, buy the audio padding for their walls to absorb the reverb. They're the ones that are willing to take it serious. They're the ones that keep coming back to me for more services. They're the ones that are willing to pay me to run their Facebook ads for them. So at that point, I realized 80% of my income is coming from this 20%, these business people, these people that are serious about their podcast, and they don't just see it as a hobby. They don't see it as an expense. They see it as an investment. And so at that point, I made the decision, I'm only going to do business podcasts from this point forward, with the exception of my own podcast. In most businesses, you're going to get to that point. You're going to realize this small section of people, these are the ones that really keep my business afloat. And if you're a smart business owner, it goes back to planting your flag.
Right.
I had
right.
to turn away a bunch of my clients and say, I'm only focusing my time on these three or four clients because they're the ones that are actually making my business sustainable. It's hard to do. I hurt a bunch of people's feelings and I even soured a couple of relationships. But overall, for the clients that I'm still serving, it was in their best interest. It was in my best interest. And again, it's one of those things where you have to make sacrifices along the way. You have to sacrifice some of the things that you want in order to provide what the market wants.
But along the way, you're also eliminating so much frustration, first and foremost, for yourself. Not chasing business that isn't the right match, not trying to fit yourself in to what somebody else needs or what somebody else is, or catering to somebody else's hangups or limitations. Define what you're best at and then match yourself with the people that skill set can help the most, where the greatest leverage is. That's a really good instinct to have in anything that you're doing, that it's a select group of people that are really, really right for you. And one of the things in podcasting, it's hard because you want to attract a huge audience. You want to have 100,000 YouTube subscribers, and you want to be able to say that, you know, we're in iTunes What's Hot because 25 or 50,000 people listen to this show.
And we're going to get a little bit meta here, but I'm going to specifically talk about your case because me and you meet every single week and we kind of help each other with our businesses. And I know a lot of insider baseball stuff. And if you don't mind, can we kind of go down that
path? I'd love to. It'd be great.
Okay. So when it comes to what you do, you have a funnel that just is missing that last piece. You have a huge audience. You provide something that attracts your ideal. Before you did the podcast, you were in education. You know, you did tutoring, you did education and private schooling, and you have an insight about what works and what doesn't work in education that most educators out there have no idea about.
Sure.
You've built a great lead acquisition model through School Sucks Project. You've built something that you give out for free that attracts the type of people that could really benefit from your higher level service, but you haven't really developed what that higher level service is. And you're at the point now, what I see you doing, and from some of the stuff that I know that goes on behind the scenes, you're at the point now where you're saying, okay, I've built this big audience. Now I've got something that is of higher level value to a specific amount. It's not going to be for everybody that listens, but for the people that do listen, this is going to be something that makes it worth your while to take our relationship to the next level. And a lot of people in the activist community, the podcasting community, a lot of us are focused on just building the audience and not figuring out what that extra level of value that we can bring to the listener is. And you're at that point where you're making that transition now. And I'm excited to see where it goes in the future. I know that it's going to be something, I know that you're going to be able to provide something that goes above and beyond what just these free episodes of the podcast deliver. But at the same time, it's not going to be for everybody that listens. And that doesn't mean you should throw away the people that listen, because you enjoy doing the podcast and you enjoy the community that you've built. But you definitely should have a next step up of the ladder for certain people in the community that want to take it to the next level.
Absolutely. And I'm really, really excited about doing that. And in fact, not only is it not for everybody, but this has to be capped. It can only hold so many people. So I'm really committed to offering it to the right people who are motivated to get as much out of it as possible when we do launch this spring. And people who listen to every episode, I've talked a little bit about what the summit is, the virtual summits are, so they know what we're talking about. But yeah, I'm super excited about that. And I'm really also excited about interacting with those people in a new way. This is definitely the next step for us. We definitely agree there. But of course we would, because we talk about this stuff every week.
We do.
Now, last couple of times you were on the show, we talked about TM Landry the last time you were here. And then we were talking about social media the time before that. But today we spent our entire conversation on the thing in which you are most expert. So I wanted to just finish up today talking about, number one, what you do on The Nathan Frazier Show and what you do at Copy and Funnels, which is your primary business website. So can we just talk about NathanFrazierShow.com first and what happens there? And I'd also like to talk about the Free Market Squad. Then we'll bring this whole show to a close.
Okay, sounds good. So Nathan Frazier Show is just me ranting about the overlap between politics and marketing. I got into marketing because of my passion about politics. I got into marketing because of my passion about how media manipulates people, about how one of the first things that I kind of delved into this aspect of my profession now was reading Edward Bernays' Propaganda back when I was still a hardcore conspiracy theorist, realizing that there's a huge overlap between the way that the government and the media kind of use each other, and realizing that a lot of the stuff that they do actually applies to marketing. And it got to the point where I was failing business after business. I had three business models where I made a decent amount of money, but nothing to actually retire off of. And my third business went down in flames because I made a huge mistake, which was the idea of if you build a better mousetrap, the world will beat a path to your door. We had built a better mousetrap. We put all of our eggs in a major retailer that we had previously worked out a deal to sell it through them. They wanted all of the rights. In order for us to get their network of selling, they wanted exclusive rights over what we had produced. We had a falling out at the end. We were left with a completely finished product and no idea how to sell it. And my team was super pissed off at me because I was too stubborn to give up the rights to what we had produced. And when we ended up, that was 2.5 years worth of work, thousands of dollars invested into it and tons of hours invested into a product that now we didn't know how to sell. At that point, I realized, well, I know how to sell. I know all of this stuff about marketing. I know all this stuff about the psyche. I know about what triggers people to make decisions. I've just never been willing to use it in my entrepreneurial pursuits. And at that point, gosh, I feel like I sold my soul to the devil, kind of. But I said, well, I've got all this information. As long as I'm using it to sell people on things that are improving their lives rather than using it to sell them their own bondage, is it really that bad to use some of these things? And so that was when I kind of made the decision to actually start looking deeper into how marketing works, how copywriting works. And Nathan Frazier Show is basically an overlap of those two things. Here's how marketing works. Here's how you can use it in your business, but here's also how it might be being used against you. Here's how the media takes advantage of these things, and here's how the government takes advantage of these things. So it's kind of like that. It's a tool, and it can be used for evil. It can be used for good. And I like to explore both sides of it.
I love it. And people learn through this about the Free Market Squad. So can we talk a little bit, you mentioned it earlier in the conversation, but can we talk in just a little bit more detail about what joining the Free Market Squad means and what happens when somebody does?
Yeah, so Free Market Squad is just a small private community that I have. It was a huge community for a while, and it just got too big to be manageable. And so I killed it and dropped it back down to zero, and I started fresh with a brand new business model. It's a couple of components. It's an online group on Facebook where we get together and we help each other with our businesses, but it's also a set of trainings. So when you join the Free Market Squad, you get a training on how to use stories to get sales. You get a training on how to get massive engagement. If anybody follows me on Facebook, they'll see that I get a lot of engagement and I make a lot of sales through Facebook. You get a training on how to write a sales page and basically the copywriting formula that I use to write most of my sales pages. And so it gives you kind of the building blocks to start off with if you're just getting into the online business world and how to, and we've also got a training with one of our mutual friends, Kevin Geary, on how to get really good free traffic coming to your website on a daily basis. Some of the stuff that he uses that me and him have developed in this course together, I use to get 20, 30, sometimes 40 leads a day without paying anything, just free traffic that comes to Podcast Blast Off. So it, basically, when you start off at the Free Market Squad, I'm giving you everything that the person that's trying to just break into business needs to actually start making an impact with their marketing without having to spend a bunch of money. And then you also get to network with the community. You'll get to meet other liberty-minded entrepreneurs. And we all just basically help each other grow. And if people want to find out more about how to join that, they can just go to freemarketsquad.com.
And finally, copyandfunnels.com is more of the service end of what you do. Like if people want to hire you for copywriting or web-related work, that happens there?
Yeah. So Copy and Funnels is just basically, it's kind of like my diary. As I'm learning things that work, as I'm figuring things out in marketing, I like to post them there. Also, a lot of the podcast episodes that I do with some of the business podcasts, I post those there as well. And then there are ways to connect with me. If you're sold on the stuff that you see there, if you're sold on the stuff that you hear there, and you want to actually hire me to start implementing some of this stuff into your own marketing, that's probably the best way to do it. Or just reach out to me on Facebook also.
So that being said, if somebody, there's lots of people, and I've actually been collecting a lot of audience feedback lately. And I know that there's a lot of people, a lot of young people who are working for themselves, either running small businesses or even just flirting with the idea of entrepreneurship. Is there somewhere specific you would point them to get started if they're up and running or at the beginning stages of this?
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of online sales. I'm a big fan of having an online presence. Websites are super cheap. You can start up your own website for $100 a year. And I'm a big fan of sending people, owning your own. Here's a big problem with trying to build your business off of YouTube or trying to build your business off of Facebook is the algorithms can change and you can build a giant audience. And then just like that tomorrow, you have no ability to reach those people in your audience anymore. So I'm a big fan of building a website for your business. The problem is most people's business websites suck. They're just basically online brochures. They're braggadocious. They're boring. They don't actually convert. They don't drive people to purchase anything. And so most of my copywriting experience, most of my marketing experience comes from businesses that have websites that are trying to generate sales. And so I actually created a guide that goes through the 7 most common mistakes that people make with their business website. So if you've got a business and you've got an online presence and you're wondering why you're not making sales off of your business website, I did put together a free guide for people if they want to check it out. It goes through the top 7 reasons people don't buy from your website and what you can do to change that and start getting sales. Stop wasting money sending people to your website that aren't converting. And if you want to check that out, you can go to copyandfunnels.com/guide. And you can get access to that free guide there.
Awesome. Well, Nathan, thank you so much for another great conversation. Come back soon. We'll do something entirely different.
You know, when I sent you Outwitting the Devil, it's because I wanted to have a podcast episode specifically about the educational takeaway from that book, because I think that Napoleon Hill was hitting on things close to 100 years ago that your podcast is just now I don't want to say just now, but the stuff that he was talking about back then, nobody else was talking about it. And you've kind of popularized that that meme out there now. But I've wanted to talk to you about that for like 3 years now, and we've never done a podcast on it. So we should do that.
What is the meme that I've popularized?
Just how education is antithetical to actual knowledge.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, it also relates to, have you heard of the Four Agreements?
Yeah, I love that book.
Okay. So who's that? The Toltecs?
Yes.
All right. So these aren't new ideas because that's a big part of the Four Agreements, if I remember correctly, is that from very early in life, you are kind of conditioned to be this thing, much to your detriment. And a lot of the book is about how to learn your way out of that conditioning. Outwitting the Devil follows a sort of similar format. Napoleon Hill famously said, the only limitation is one which you set up in your own mind, or your only limitation is the one that you set up in your own mind. But we do get a lot of help with that throughout our young lives, and the 15,000 hours that we spend in government school is certainly a huge part of that. You are told no a lot for even tasks that you could do very easily and very successfully, like pee, you know?
There you go.
So really, really valuable book. And at some point in the future, yeah, we should bring a few guys together. It could be just me and you if you like, or we could do like a roundtable discussion. Oh, Nathan, we still have to do a roundtable on Never Split the Difference.
Oh, man.
I still have outline for that. Yeah, we got to do that sometime. A book about negotiation. So we have things in the queue that I know my audience, lots of people in my audience love your work, and they love your Facebook posts and your podcast and your appearances on this podcast. So yeah, let's get you back here sooner than later, and we'll do something else. One of those.
Awesome. Ideas. Well, I just want to say thank you for inviting me on, and I had a blast today.
Awesome. My pleasure. And we'll talk again soon. 'Cause I got the real money.